Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Andrew Bishop, another station manager from BFM. He talks about what an exciting place Auckland was in the early 1980s. People who viewed things a little bit differently from the mainstream found a home at BFM.
It was just these little moments of subversion that were just so cool. Barry Jenkins on the radio and, you know, all grumbly Barry. And he played this Stranglers song on one night. I think it was Get a Grip on Yourself. I was like 14, or this is 1977, yeah, 14. And I was just like gobsmacked. And things like hearing Susie and the Banshees for the first time, their first album on the radio, and going, what is that awful noise? And then 3 weeks later, you're going, oh, you've got to hear this new band, you know? And you'd heard it three or four times, and it just grew on you. And we used to tape Barry's show on cassette players at, you know, at night, in the middle of the night. Mum and Dad were asleep, and you're in your bedroom, with covers pulled up, going, taping these things so you could play them to your mates the next day. This is what Barry played last night. And they go, yeah, I've got it too, you know? It was just so exciting. Something was happening. It was like a whole new movement in art and fashion and everything. And it was great. You could upset anybody with it. And I remember playing Sex Pistols' Frigging in the Rigging, which is an old sea shanty, and it's as rude as all hell, over the school PA at the school fair. Because we had this like in-house radio station, and I wanted to be the DJ. And playing this song, and the master of discipline at the school comes storming in and ripped it and smashed the record. And don't you ever get up, you know, just threw a fit, just about killed him. Just things like that. I remember going to Food Town in Three Kings one day, and somebody there had gotten hold of the PA and was playing Mongoloid by Devo over the supermarket PA. And it's this, you know, Mongoloid, one chromosome too many song. And there's all these shoppers wandering around blissfully listening to it. And they didn't know what they were listening to.
What year did you first come to BFM?
I think it was about 1981, but my memory from those days is not as good as it should be. My brother Phil had been DJing at the station for a couple of years before, and I wasn't going to join the station because I thought, oh, I don't want to be his, you know, following in his footsteps. But they had a workshop one weekend, and I went up and thought, oh yeah, okay, I'll give it a try. And it was quite weird. The people that were there was myself, Francis from World, a guy called James Shonning, who did the breakfast shows from then on, a whole bunch of people who sort of went on and did things, and a bunch of people that dropped out too. But
so were you at university at the time, or were you still at high school?
No, I was at university. Okay. That was my first year doing architecture. I think after 2 years, they threw me out for insufficient academic progress, which they sent you this thing called Form X, and it was like, fill this out and we'll think about letting you back in. I was like, oh, okay. Those days, the station was only on air for orientation and holidays, so it was only on for maybe 5-10 weeks a year. The rest of the time, it was just broadcasting through the quad, so you could do what you liked, and it didn't really matter as long as you didn't swear too much. And it was, you know, it was just fun, and everybody hung out and had a good time, listened to records. We got free records from the record companies, and you know, it was the latest releases and all this sort of really exciting stuff, and we had shit before other people. So we felt pretty good. We got invited to concerts and met bands and did all that sort of stuff. I was here for 4 years. I did the first year, I was just basically a pleb, did nothing. A couple of shows here and there if I was lucky. And then the next year I became production manager, did ads, things like that. We used to do all our ads out at Radio Pacific in Manukau, and we'd drive out on Sunday night, and Karen Hayes' brother Bryce ran the studios out there, and we swapped studio time on Sunday night for favours, tickets, t-shirts, whatever we had, you know, available. And he was quite good with that sort of thing. And we'd go charging out there in the student union van. They had this terrible crapped out van, and we'd all be smoking out large on the way out. There'd be this big van full of smoke heading south, and we'd get out there and we'd write and produce all the ads in maybe 3-4 hours for the next week or 2 weeks. One night's work was incredibly intense and incredibly creative, so the ads became just little works of art. You know, they really were, you know, things about chopping people's heads off and stuff like that, and aeroplane noises and stuff. And one night we get out there, and Francis from World's there, and he's got on red check trousers, red and purple, black sort of check trousers, paisley shirt, red Winkelpicker shoes. His hair was like bright orange with red bits. And they had this guy on here who was called Bunny Wriggled, who was an old former sergeant major from the army. And he sees Francis walk past the booth window and he comes storming out, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And Francis turns around and goes, "Oh, fuck off. Oh man, we're going to get so thrown out of this place. The security will be here any time." But he just went back in his booth and took off again. And so we made our ads and went home. One night we were going home in my car and one of the guys had his TV set in the boot. And what we didn't realise was that the aerial lead was hanging out the boot. And so we got stopped by some cops in Papakura, somewhere south. We'd just been smoking this huge cigarette. Car stunk of it. There was this huge roach on the floor, and the cops pull us over, and we're like, "Oh, we're so busted," and we got away with it. He thought we'd just done a little burg, and we're on our way home. We're flying through Pakuranga at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you know, things were pretty exciting and loose, and we had a great time. Down in Splendor by Straight Jacket Fitz. The reason I chose that song was because we used to go down to Wellington for radio conferences with all the what's now the BNet, and we'd have our little conferences on how to boost our ratings and be together and be wonderful and all this sort of carry on. And one year they put on a party for us at some club on Oriental Parade, and the Double Happies played. That was pretty exciting. They were like a brand new band then, and you know, Joe 90 and all that stuff. And it was just really exciting. We just had a blast and wandered home, had to climb up the cable car in the evening to get to the student dorms, and the whole thing was always loose. There was nothing pre-planned, nothing went right. It was always the same. We had two assistant station managers. It was myself and Francis, and I think Francis bailed halfway through the year or something and left me to do it. I can't remember why. We had a few weird things like that with people. One stage we had a production manager who quit because we thought about accepting advertising from the Air Force. In the end, we didn't take it because the Air Force wouldn't allow women on the flight deck, and that was against student union rules, so we got out of it that way. But it was a lot of money, and we were skint, and we thought, well, you know, who's it really going to hurt? Because none of our listeners are ever going to join the bloody Air Force, are they? People had very high morals at BFM. They wouldn't play certain types of music. Some people wouldn't stop playing certain types of music. Francis loved Michael Jackson and got thrown off air several times for playing that sort of crap. Poor bugger's dead, but I never really liked him anyway, so it doesn't really worry me. Celia Patel, do you remember Celia? Mm-hmm. Was in a band, Mancini's and all that stuff. She got thrown off air because she wouldn't play the playlist, and everything was just straight goth the whole way through. It was like, it was goth or die as far as Celia was concerned, you know, quite appropriate really. So there were lots of characters and people like that, but Debbie was in charge when I was assistant station manager, and together we sat down and did the first warrant application for FM. And then the next year we did full-time application, which I think I sent away to the Broadcasting Tribunal and got a full-time warrant. And from then on we went 24/7, and it was full on. It was, we hadn't really planned on doing it, but we thought we'd get knocked back and it wouldn't, you know, it would be sweet and we wouldn't have to do too much work. But that year the Broadcasting Tribunal objected to the warrant that I'd written, the application I'd written, and we thought, oh God, this is it. We did this big letter writing campaign, sent off all the information, and the Broadcasting Tribunal turned around and said, well, actually, we really like the station. We want to promote it. We think it's a good training ground, yada, 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 and gave us everything we'd applied for. And we were like, oh, bloody hell, how are we going to do this? We didn't have the staff. We didn't have, you know, the facilities or anything. We're up to scratch. So, but we made it through and scrambled, and it happened. So it was great. But Debbie was, her family were, how do you say it? They were people that achieved highly. Debbie's dad's the one that built the Aquata and all that. And, you know, she had aspirations for the station and she knew how to make it happen. And that was quite good. She introduced things like the station magazine, the Book of Biffin, which went on to become something else. And subscription radio was Debbie's idea, the B-card idea, and that came from her. So, you know, there's been a lot of people that have put a lot into it. She was definitely someone that made a big change to the station for the better. She always had a mission. This has to be done here, this has to be done there. And we were all in our 20s and she was the odd one out in that respect. You know, the rest of us were just happy to go in the other room and have a joint and get on with it. Fold some paint pictures in two and see what sort of patterns came out, that sort of, you know, stupid carry-on. And the music round then was really exciting. It was the birthday party and the sort of first goth bands were coming out, and things like Sex Scan Children, Alien Sex Fiend, Bauhaus, all that were really big back then, and that was the sort of music we were listening to. And but there were sort of two factions at the station. There was the sort of proletariat fall fans who were, you know, very serious about their music and their lifestyle and their check pants and had to be anti-fashion, and they were all linked in with the Flying Nun crowd. They'd go around to Chris's place and hang out there and be cool and stuff like that. And that was cool, but I sort of wasn't really interested in that, and I liked fashion a lot more, which sort of came out in my later life. I jumped on any bandwagon that came along, and, you know, dark clothes, broody kids, and, you know, today's emos were yesterday's goths. It was a fun time. Cabaret Voltaire, a song called Just Fascination from about that period of time. Probably one of the very first techno bands, excluding things like Kraftwerk. They were inventors of a thing called the Sheffield Bleep, which was huge in the early 90s techno scene, and they were like the fathers of it all. They also invented a video thing whereby they had a camera on an A-frame that lifted over the person as they walked under it, And that was the forerunner to videos like U2, The Fly, I think it is. And all that Matrix video effects all came from that one video. I did a show each week on Thursday called Spot, special program on Thursday it was. That was like a new music show, which I'd play whatever I could find. We used to go down to Sounds and Robin had let us raid the record bins in return for contra advertising. And what a great guy, he gave us such good music. I remember getting stuff from there before anyone, you know, the week it came out in England, we had things like New Order Blue Monday. I remember with that record, we ran up to, Francis was working at a club called Retro, which later became Squid in O'Connell Street, and now it's a lawyer's office. And we ran up there and they were filming a TV show called Heroes. If you remember that, about a local music band. And And we couldn't play the record because we wanted to play it on the club system, you know, in the middle of the day, as you do. And they wouldn't let us because they were filming this stupid thing. And as soon as they stopped filming, Francis whacks this record on, and we were just like, oh my God, what is this, you know? And we just went immediately, just got so into it. The drum beat just started, and, you know, boom, 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 as it does. We were just blown away. It just changed everything from that moment on, and it was incredible. They'd done really well for themselves. They'd lost their singer and then restarted, and somewhere along the line they discovered this disco beat from New York, and bang, and the technology they were developing themselves. They used to build their own instruments with Martin Hannett, their producer, and they did their own sequences and all this stuff, and they released that. Not long after that, they came out and played in Auckland for the first time, I think. The first night they got up to about the third song in the set, which was Everything's Gone Green, and everything turned off. And the crowd, they just walked off stage. They were just a temperamental band, and the crowd just didn't really like that at all. The next track, a song called Your Silent Face by New Order.
Path we cannot take. You caught me out.
us a little bit about your band.
Oh, thanks. Let's talk about your band, Patrick.
There'll be another whole episode just for me to talk.
Just for me. Right. I was at a club called A Certain Bar one night, and that was run by Peter Ehrlich and his mate Mark Phillips. Not the Mark Phillips, but a Mark Phillips. And they'd brought all these records back from London. And in those days, the pubs closed at 11. That was it. You go home. Or you went to a nightclub, which closed at 1. And then afterwards, we'd go to one of Patrick's little parties down in the Domain, and he'd bring his ghetto blaster and some reggae music, and we'd go and spend the rest of the night there. And anyway, so I'm at this bar, and it was quite a posy place. It was sort of the beginning of the new romantic era. Pardon me. Yeah, I mean, things like Duran Duran's first single, which was Planet Earth, I think, which was sort of like a disco, sort of leftover punk thing, but not really all that punk, just quite weird and quite fashion and quite neat. And so Mark and Peter opened up this club that was, it was basically the first cool disco in Auckland. There was a few dodgy sort of places down in Elliot Street where you could get drinks late at night, but this was really cool. And it was just in this bar, and everyone would go on Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights, and drinks were $1.70 for a double. And it was great. Anyway, I'm standing there, and this guy comes up to me and says, "Do you want to be in a band? What do I play?" He goes, "Oh, keyboards." I went, "No, I can't play keyboards," thinking I might be able to get out of it. Anyway, they put the letters of the keys on this crappy old keyboard for me and told me which buttons to push. So I pushed A, C, D, whatever, and went from there. And
of course, you were recruited because standing there in a certain bar, you just looked great.
That's what it was all about. There was no other reason to it. I mean, the guy who had left the band was a fashion photographer, and they'd sort of made a decision. They wanted somebody with a look, and it was all about look. It was nothing else. The band was called Sons in Jeopardy, a very deep and meaningful name, which, you know, we wanted to call ourselves Zeitgeist, but we thought it was too bloody heavy metal. And it was, you know, it would have been Zeitgeist, we've come to get you. So we called ourselves Sons in Jeopardy because it was deep and it was meaningful. It was a bunch of ass. So we got together and we had guitar, bass, drums and keyboards, and the guitarist sang, and we had a great time. We played it. I think the first gig was out in some minor little church hall in Howick. You know, Silent Decree, I think your band was one of the only other bands in Auckland that were on the same page as what we were on. That was quite some ride. We played at Russell Crowe's venue. Did you play there?
Yep. That was called The Venue.
The Venue. Yep. Very creative, Russell. Yep. And we used to call him Rustler Cock. He called himself Rustler Rock. And it was Rustly Rock. Rustly. Yeah. He's very rustly as rustly. But he was earnest. He wanted to do something for the kids because there was nothing. And good on him. He did it. He got it up. And it was all painted black. And I remember finding lots of money on the floor there. Every time I went in there, I'd find 10, 20 bucks. It was like, I'm coming back here. Well, we put out two singles. We recorded one at Harlequin, which was the studio at the time. We had a really good manager who came up with some money from somewhere. And we recorded there, and the sound was awful. It was really tinny. They used to charge you to use the reverb machine. That was extra. It was like, so what are we here for? We might as well just record in the garage, you know. But the sound quality of the room was amazing. It was so, you could sleep in there while they were rewinding the tape at 1,000 feet per second, and you're fast asleep. It didn't make any difference. The acoustics were so good. Then the next one was at Glyn Tucker Jr.'s studio, Mandrill. There it was completely different. They'd mic up the toilets to get a good echo sound and things like that. They were creative, and we worked with Trevor Reeky on that, and that sounded much better. The songs were pretty below average, but, you know, we weren't Lennon and McCartney. But that's all right. We had a good time, pulled some chicks, had some fun, and we did two videos.
Wow.
And funny thing was, a couple of years ago, I was working at our shop up in Ponsonby, talking to this girl, and or young woman as she is now, and she said, "Oh, I remember your band. I danced in front of you at the Shazam video shoot." And this program was hosted by Philip Schofield, and he told us a dirty joke. And he was such a little nerd. Now he's a big star in England. It's just embarrassing, eh? We have sort of crossed paths with all these people that have exploded in the world. But yeah, so we did this video, and it cost like $1,000 to make because it was just in a dark studio with a bit of dry ice. And afterwards, all these kids swamped us. They thought we were great. And but none of them had come near me because I had like hair, the first time hair extensions came out, I had hair down to my ass, and I was wearing this string of pearls and big old army jumper and boots and stuff, and had full makeup on. Must look like a ripe fruit. But that was what you did back then to offend people and shock people. So they mobbed all the others and just left me standing
away.
I was like, well, Mum's told us about people like you. So that was quite funny. And then the other video we did was with a guy called Andy Shaw, who used to be Here's Andy on TV. He became a director for Radio with Pictures. I think New Zealand On Air had just started, and they spent $15,000, which in those days was like a fortune.
That's megabucks.
We had the National Film Unit filming us in Woodhill State Forest for 2 nights. It was like a movie set. It was incredible. We were supposed to have an international model as the chick in the video. They got some girl from the office at TVNZ. Pretty, I suppose, but making her bid for stardom too. And anyway, so they had a guy called Chaz Biggin, who was a cinematographer, director of photography, and he was just brilliant. This thing looked amazing through the camera lens. All these warm sort of, you know, the colour of pine needles when they've decayed a bit and they're gold brown. And it was all lit with these big, huge lights like you get on movies, and it's like these warm yellow patches and this brown and stuff like that. So Andy Shaw stripped all the colour out of it to make it look like a 40s video film noir thing. The editing was all out of time with the drum beat, and it was just turned into a disaster. And I was much more proud of the $1,000 Shazam effort. We played at this nightclub once called Keys down on Key Street, which I think is now set back open, sort of some sort of club thing down there or something. And we set up this whole stage, and it was amazing. We used masking tape that we spray paint with fluoro paint, and then we put UV lights up in the roof and turned everything black. And then we, due to come on stage, we flipped on the UV lights, and it was like some video from Tron, and it just looked so cool. And that was just amazing. It was quite fun. That sort of that aspect of it was just the best part. Right, this is Bauhaus with Bela Lugosi's Dead. This was the biggest selling indie single of just about all time, I should think. It was on the charts for 10 years, the indie charts in NME. We'll be right back.
The bats have left the bell tower. The victims have been bled red velvet lines. The black box, Bela Lugosi is dead. Bela Lugosi is dead.
I want to talk a little bit about Francis Hooper as well, because I think the reason being is that you were both here at BFM at the same time, and then you both went off to kind of start your own labels. Francis opened a little shop, World, just across the arcade from where Feline was, because it meant people from BFM or your friends could go down there, have a look at what was new in your shop, say hi, how's it going, Andrew, and then like pop across the way and say hi, Francis, how's it, you know, and a look at what sort of goodies he had in his.
Yeah, High Street back then was like a little community. It was like a little village inside the city. And yeah, we'd been open for 2 years, and Francis, we'd been really close all the way through university and stuff like that, and he was working in a shop called Jag Men, which was an Australian label, and it was, he was working with this gay guy, Murray, who was quite the piece of work, this guy. He was the absolute epitome of a gay guy working in a menswear store. He was just, and he was, you know, party central, and that suited Francis, and we used to hang out because his shop was across the road from ours. And then one day the shop, little tiny shop about the size of the sound booth, which, you know, it's not very big, came up for lease. And I said to Francis, you know, mate, look, you got a kid on the way. You should do something. And this space is coming up. You know, you could probably do something in it. And, you know, creative guy sort of thing, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so him and Denise came up with World. And started it in there, and it grew from there. And we sort of, I don't know about competed, but we were in the same market at the same time and did shows together, and we did all these fashion shows all through the city, like hundreds of them, and things like Overdrive that Shane O'Neill used to run and Andrew Tidball was involved in as well, back in his early days. It was a great time to be in fashion in Auckland, because there wasn't any really, you know, there was Zambezian Workshop, and that was about it. That fashion thing that was missing in Auckland, there was the mainstream fashion, and there was nothing else, except for maybe Sue Kim, occasionally people like that that came through. And so we thought we were the shit, you know, and we'll do it, and we're going to conquer the world. And so we started off, and we did a bit of sort of streety, clubby stuff. At first, Tanya had a shop in Wyndham Street on her own. She used to sew in the shop and make one-off orders for people and stuff like that. And then we moved to High Street and took over half of the Cut of Newton shop, which was Mike O'Neill from the Screaming Mimi's shop. And Mike O'Neill, who's now Liquid Studios and does all the ads that you hear on TV. He's brainwashing your children, he is, with all his old Screaming Mimi songs. We know, Michael. And it's quite funny where people end up. And so we started doing the sort of clubby stuff, and the baggy stuff hit around the same time as the Happy Mondays, early 90s. All that sort of late acid house, early, what was it, Madchester stuff?
Yeah, Madchester, that's Madchester. Right. Smiley faces.
Young Adam Puttick used to wear our clothing. Mm. Yes. Snowy, we used to call him, because he had peroxide blonde hair back then. And there's this 6'3" freak with blonde hair running around in this pair of huge overalls that were bright red and yellow with a matching jacket. And, you know, it was just mental. You could go as loud as you wanted to, and people just lapped it up. We had people fighting over clothes after fashion shows. We got burgled after fashion shows. There was none of this sort of chain store crap in there. There was no pumpkin patch or anything like that there. It was just little retailers doing their thing and creating really cool stuff. It's sort of like what happens up on K Road now. It's a bit more of that vibe, or maybe parts of Ponsonby. But it's now priced itself out of the market for little retailers. You can't afford to be in there. It wasn't like, you know, the last 10 years where there's been clubs and pubs everywhere. There was only one place to be in Auckland, and it was always the same place. And it was usually the same people, Mark and Peter, running it.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
You know, you couldn't get away from it. Zanzibar Key. It started off with sort of part punk, part Frank Sinatra, and sort of grew its way through soul and various other things, and then ended up coming out the other end with Simon running the Siren and
the Box.
The Box. And you know, people like Ice-T and you name it playing in these little tiny clubs, and it was so cool. I found that a lot of the things I was supposed to like really just didn't push my buttons, and then things that other people frowned on that I really loved, I just thought, oh, well, told you, I'm gonna play it anyway. You know, and I was playing things like Alien Sex Fiend, who were this very early Batcave goth band, and stuff like that. And I was also playing Prince, you know, and stuff like that, because he was subversive. There's this little freak on stage in this sort of like James Brown Soul Review band, wearing high heels, like 7-inch high heels, and stroking his guitar and carrying on like a complete idiot, and talking about tourists and paisley shirts and things like that. And you know, just in this total sexy way, and it was really cool. And you know, then Prince became really big, and I was like, oh yeah, I've been there and done that. Then he became uncool again, and it was like, oh yeah, I like him again now. That whole Purple Rain thing sort of killed it a bit, but when you look back on it now, it's a brilliant album, and I think they're replaying the movie shortly on C4 or something. And it's beautiful. But
don't worry, I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
There's a lot of things that have really pushed my buttons, and I think the next one is something I'm going to play for you. It's a band called the Psychedelic Furs, who started their career in 1977 as a really obnoxious little punk band, and then went on to become sort of worldwide superstars, mainly because of some Molly Ringwald movie called Pretty in Pink. And but they were pretty good. They played at Sweetwater's one year, and I remember going with Francis round to the front of the stage, and we got press passes so we could take photographs. And they were just, it was awesome. They, back in the day, we used to promote a whole album for a weekend. We'd do giveaways, and it worked really well for the record company, and it broke a whole lot of acts. This is one of them, the Psychedelic Furs and President Gas.
Oh,
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a radio documentary series produced to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society airs every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is replayed as a podcast from BFM's website later in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.